It's a process that goes on in our bodies around the clock, every minute of our lives. Metabolism is the subject of today's edition of Please Explain. And joining me now to discuss it are Dr. Marion Nestle, the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at the New York University. Her most recent book is What to Eat. It's published by North Point Press. That's the paperback edition now. And also with us is Dr. Rosalind Coleman, a professor of nutrition and pediatrics at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Welcome to our show.
Glad to be here.
Rosalind, let's begin with you. Does metabolism begin at the moment of conception?
Yes, it does. Of course. Every cell in our bodies has to undergo various forms of metabolism, and that first fertilized egg is the beginning.
And so as the eggs are cleaving, we're already metabolizing.
We are.
But what does that mean? What does it mean when we talk about metabolism?
Well, I think it's easier to understand in terms of food coming into our bodies and being used for energy, but even the single-cell egg is getting nutrients from its environment, and mostly from the mother, and converting those nutrients into energy, the energy that it needs to maintain itself and its membranes and its vital functions and the energy it needs to divide.
So every living being metabolizes, amoebas do, paramecium?
Absolutely.
Algae?
Mm-hmm.
Marion,
yes,
if we get past all of those and we narrow our focus to human metabolism, what's the first step in the process of converting food that that we all eat into energy?
Well, it starts in the mouth. You start chewing up the food into small pieces, and then enzymes in the mouth start doing the initial work of digestion, which is to convert all of the parts of the foods we eat, the plants, the peas, the carrots, the pigs, the fish, whatever it is we're eating. The whole point of metabolism is to take all of what those edible foods are, break them down into little teeny subunits, and the brilliant part about it is that those subunits are exactly the same in all living creatures. So we take food, break it down, and then convert what's in food into our own body parts.
But doesn't saliva change according to help break us down according to what we're eating?
Well, no, it's got enzymes in it that are already there, and those enzymes begin the process, especially with sugars. Most digestion takes place in the small intestine. So it has to get through the stomach to get there.
And how do enzymes work? How do they break it down?
Well, they're proteins that are essentially catalysts. They are structured in a way that brings things together and makes reactions happen in the body. And they happen very quickly.
And then they change these proteins into amino acids?
They break them down into the common subunits, which in the case of proteins is amino acids. And the amino acids in carrots, spinach, cauliflower, wheat are exactly the same amino acids that we have in our bodies. And so we take the amino acids from all the foods we eat and make our own proteins out of them. Or we burn them for energy, but that's a different step.
Well, Rosam, what happens at a cellular level? How does the amino acid get used by the cell, or what facilitates that use?
Well, it depends really on the cell needs. So first of all, the amino acid has to enter the cell, and there are processes that allow it to do so, very specific processes. And then, depending on the conditions in that particular cell, that the amino acid will be used to make new proteins, or it will be converted into something that then can be used for energy. So it really depends on how many new proteins are being made by the cell, whether those proteins need that particular kind of amino acid. We have more than 20 different varieties of amino acids, and they are all needed in various amounts for different specific proteins. So it's kind of a moment-to-moment process.
What other systems in the body contribute to the regulation of metabolism?
Well, I think it's probably better to think to start off with maybe carbohydrates and fats, which are much bigger contributors to energy metabolism than proteins are. And the major hormones that contribute to that kind of metabolism are insulin and then a variety of counter-regulatory hormones, including glucagon and epinephrine.
What about
known as adrenaline?
What is adrenaline known as?
Epinephrine. It's the same. It's the same compound. It's just a different name.
And that speeds us up?
Yes, it does.
Well, Mary, when we talk about having a fast metabolism, a slow metabolism, is the thyroid the thing that we're usually talking about?
Well, it's part of it, but metabolism is enormously regulated by probably 50 or more different factors. And that's because the whole point of metabolism is to make sure that we have enough blood sugar to keep our brains operating. And so the whole thing is set up to defend sugars in the brain. And that requires lots and lots and lots of different regulatory processes to make sure that if one goes wrong, the other one will still work. It would be very bad if our brains didn't have enough sugar.
Well, there are times when we hear that people have low sugar.
Well, if it's low enough, they go into a coma. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens with people with diabetes who get too much insulin, for example.
My guests are Dr. Marion Nessel and Dr. Rosalind Coleman. We're talking about metabolism on today's Please Explain here on WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is there a big difference in the process depending on whether the body is metabolizing an organic compound, a fat or a protein, as opposed to a vitamin or a mineral?
Oh, sure. Fats, proteins, and carbohydrates are the sources of energy. Vitamins and minerals are not. So with carbohydrates, you break them down to sugars and use those sugars to construct body materials or make energy. With protein, you're making amino acids. With fats, you're making fatty acids. And the fatty acids and sugars are the main sources of energy. They're broken down into little bitty pieces, and the energy is tapped off along the way.
Why did things go wrong, Rosalind? Because some people do these things better than others.
Well, this is a question that's really bothering everyone these days, I think. And I think it's useful, perhaps, to think about what we actually use energy for. And we have basal energy, which are all the processes that have to happen all the time, no matter what, like breathing and your heart beating and maintaining your body temperature and making sure that the amount of sodium and potassium and glucose in your blood are within very constant ranges. And then there's the energy that's expended for exercise, which is the kind of energy that we can do something about on top of that. And so there are enormous variations, not in the basal energy that we expend, which is, I guess, primarily related to the amount of lean body mass, our muscle mass. So people with more muscle mass have a greater basal energy expenditure. But on top of that, there is the movement factor, the exercise factor, or even involuntary movements. People who are
fidgeting,
creamers, or tapping their toes are expending energy.
I'm inviting listeners to call, by the way. Our number
Sure.
here is 212-433-9692. Yeah. That's 212-433-WNYC. Well, along these lines, Marion, one scientist we spoke to said that some people are naturally hummingbirds and others are more naturally bears. One type with a high metabolism rate, another with a rather slower, more sluggish rate. Are we just born with these differences?
Well, there's some evidence that we are. Certainly a lot of studies on the Pima Indians in Arizona who are exceptionally obese at a very early age show that even little babies don't fidget as much if they're predisposed to becoming obese. I'm a fidgeter. I'm always, you know, sitting here moving the chair and doing that kind of thing.
I'm doing that too.
I bet you don't have a weight problem either.
No.
Or at least not much of one.
So fidgeters are less likely to have a weight problem?
Well, yeah, because they're burning off more energy.
And is simply that, just moving around a lot will do it?
Oh, it's very important to do that. And because physical activity not only uses calories, but it also raises it just balances calories a lot better.
But if the Pima Indians, for example, mm-hmm. are more prone to obesity, to a slower metabolism rate, that would suggest that genetics play a role. Have we been studying that? We mentioned earlier that the metabolism begins at the moment of conception. So can we see what's going to happen if we study a fetus?
I think not so easily. Genetics certainly accounts for some proportion of obesity, but most obesity is due to overeating calories with respect to physical activity. And it's not that people...
But aren't there some people who are just natural? I mean, there are people who are large. And there are some people who are tiny, and that's just...
Yes, and that's certainly
the way they were born. And their family come from large families or small families.
Yeah, but behavior has a lot to do with it. And the it's not that people are overeating 25, 50, or 100 calories that's making people overweight. It's people overeat hundreds and hundreds of calories a day. And that's too hard to handle. Metabolism can't handle a huge excess of calories.
So it's really... Go ahead, Roslyn.
Oh, I was going to say, well, two things, one of which is that one's weight at birth really has more to do with the intrauterine environment than one's long-term genetic propensity. But the other thing is that even with the Pima Indians, it's my understanding that there is a group of Pima Indians who live in Mexico and are living their traditional life where they're doing rather difficult physical exercise and eating a very...
much more sensibly.
Diet. And this group, which is exactly the same genetically as Pima Indians in this country, these people are lean and not diabetic. And so there is a lot to say for there is, of course, a genetic component, but the Pima Indians who have moved to the United States or live in the United States are not different genetically, but their environment is very different.
They're eating a lot more junk food.
So it's simply a matter of avoiding junk food because we see
that would help.
Because we see diets that promise to regulate our metabolism. There are supplements out there in so-called health food stores. Did I get myself in trouble by saying so-called? Because there's a lot of good stuff in those health food stores, but sometimes it seems to me there are things that we probably don't really need. But do those things really work?
Well, the simplest way to think about maintaining body weight is to think about calories. And those other things are in there. If they can help you maintain a reasonable calorie balance, I'm all for them. But they don't. Usually.
And calories and metabolism, what's the link there?
Well, calories have to do with, the number of calories that you need on a daily basis are there to cover your basal metabolic needs and to cover your needs for activity. So you need more calories if you're more physically active. If you take in too many calories, you're going to turn the food that you eat into fat.
Roslyn, what about sleep? Does it matter how many hours we sleep in regard to how our metabolism works?
Well, our metabolism during sleep is at its low point because most people don't have very much activity going on.
I don't know about the fidgeters.
Well, I'm not sure. But in any case, where was I going with
sleep? I was talking about sleep and metabolism. If I sleep 6 hours and the next person sleeps 8 hours and another one sleeps 10 hours, is that going to show up?
Well, I think that for the time that you're awake, you're by definition more active. So yes, it will show up. But I do believe that there's evidence that people who do not get enough sleep actually are more inclined to become obese. So I'm not sure how that plays out. Maybe
I think they're eating more.
Because they're up more hours.
Yeah, they have more hours to eat.
Well, let's say along those lines, let's take a call from Celeste from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. We've all heard that you're not supposed to skip breakfast, but my husband says that when he does not eat breakfast, when he does eat breakfast, he ends up hungry again in a couple of hours. On the other hand...
And he doesn't get hungry if he doesn't eat breakfast?
No, he doesn't get hungry if he skips breakfast. So he can make it till 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon and without eating, and therefore he feels like he is winning because he's eating less.
He's winning. Will this marriage last?
That's the question. No, it's important for you to eat first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism. But he says that if he does that, he'll end up feeling hungry an hour or two later.
I think many people say this, and I think there's some truth to it. But I think that perhaps a higher protein breakfast can help, and also planning to eat part of your breakfast in mid-morning, so spreading that out can help. Because the problem with waiting a long time, it may not be true for your husband, but it is true for many people, is that one is so ravenously hungry at 1 in the afternoon, then one overdoes it.
I better confess, I'm not a breakfast eater either. I can't bear the thought of food first thing in the morning, and I don't get hungry until about 11. I think people should eat when they're hungry.
We are talking about metabolism on today's Please Explain and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. My guests are Dr. Marion Nessel, the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. And we also have Dr. Rosalind Coleman, Professor of Nutrition and Pediatrics at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And we'll be back with more of your calls after this. We're back with Dr. Rosalind Coleman, Professor of Nutrition and Pediatrics at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And Dr. Marion Nessel, the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. And we're talking about metabolism on today's Please Explain. Before we get to some more calls, there are any number of ableism words, and I throw this out to both of you. What is anabolism and what is catabolism?
Oh, anabolism is putting muscles on, and catabolism is taking them off. So it's building and breaking down.
And the we body want to do both?
Oh, yeah. The body is in, it's not fixed. Nothing is fixed. So bones and muscles and all of the body parts are constantly being renewed and broken down and renewed and broken down. So that's all that means.
Let's go to our next caller, Carrie from Reading. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is a wonderful show. I'm about to turn 50, and I'm noticing I've always struggled with my weight my whole life. I'm not terribly overweight, but I find now I can't even eat a bagel. If I do, I feel like I just can't lose any weight. I'm probably about 10, 15 pounds overweight, and it's just become a real struggle, and I wonder what the doctors think about what happens as you approach perimenopause and menopause, about what happens to your metabolism.
Well, I want to spread this out because it's not just women. Men also wind up having, I know when I was younger, if I wanted to lose some pounds, I just cut out dessert for 3 days and there was no problem.
Right.
Now I cut out dessert and I still gain weight. And I've cut out sugar and there are other factors. I don't know why I lose weight when I lose it and why I gain it when I gain it. But as you get older, you do put on more weight.
I think it's the dirtiest trick about getting old.
I agree.
No, I used to be able to eat anything, and it's just such a problem. I think metabolism slows down.
And does menopause play a part in it for women?
Well, it must. It must, because everybody I know, and me too, had trouble with it, and you just have to adjust and eat less. It's a very difficult adjustment. I think it's quite unfair.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course it is. And one of the things is that even if you maintain your weight in a steady way, you actually have less muscle mass and more of that weight is fat. So that your actual rate of metabolism has for sure slowed, because most of that basal metabolism is really controlled by the amount of lean muscle mass you have. Basal metabolism.
That's the housekeeping functions, heart rate, lungs, breathing, that kind of thing. And that's why it's so important for people to keep active when they get older. Keep that muscle mass up.
Along these lines, we are putting now Yvonne from Brooklyn on the air. Hi, Yvonne.
Hi. What she just said was exactly what the point I was bringing up. I'm a prior weightlifter. I'm 61, female. And I have, in my reading, come across the fact that a pound of muscle burns, depending on one's overall weight, 30, 40, 50 calories a day, and a pound of fat burns only 2 calories a day. And that dieting and aerobic exercise alone will end up burning off more muscle mass, even though you lose weight. And so overall, in the end, you end up gaining weight because you can't burn it off if you have more fat than muscle.
You're nodding your head, Marion.
Well, that's the point, is that if you're losing muscle mass, then you've got to make up for it by eating less. But I think it's just extraordinary. I mean, there's so much evidence now coming in that about how important it is to stay physically active as you get older. And I'm not talking about lifting weights necessarily or going to a gym, just walking and being active and walking up a few stairs and trying to spend that half hour to an hour a day moving around, and that gets you outside. It's good anyway.
I spoke to a doctor at a geriatric hospital who said that he was amused to notice that all the older doctors took the stairs and all the younger doctors took the elevator.
They'll learn.
I guess they were practicing what they were preaching, at least the older ones.
Good for them.
Stephanie from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is a great show. I am about to be 50, and I have always had what I would refer to as a good metabolism. You know, my weight was always very stable. And a couple of years ago, I was taking an SSRI to fix sort of the brain dysfunction that comes with menopause, and it worked, except that I gained 30 pounds in 3 to 4 weeks. So obviously that was bad, and I thought, okay, I get off the medication, but I continued to gain weight after that, and it seems that it has completely changed my metabolism. You know, I never had this problem before, and now getting the weight back off is practically impossible. So can a drug actually change your metabolism?
Rosalind?
This is a tough question. I'm wondering whether it was in part coincidence that it was occurring at the time of menopause anyway, when your metabolism probably was changing.
Well, but I've been in menopause for a couple of years at that point, so I don't think so.
Let me follow up on this, Rosalind.
Yeah.
Because people who are bipolar, who take drugs to regulate themselves, tend to also put on a lot of weight. People who take drugs for rheumatoid arthritis tend to put on weight. So those drugs must have some effect on the metabolism.
They do. Many of the psychoactive drugs are drugs that make people want to eat more. And one of the worries is that there is some truth to this, the idea that there is a set point that your body somehow has become comfortable with, and it's kind of focused on maintaining that amount of weight. And I think it's not very well understood, but it seems very obvious when you actually observe people that they have this comfortable weight, and when they make an extraordinary effort to lose weight, it's just enormously easy for them to regain it. And if they actually eat more food, if they're in some sort of study where they're eating more food and gaining weight, it's relatively easy for them to get back down to the lower weight. At least it is true for animals. I'm not that sure that it's that easy for humans. So there may have been something that did disturb your brain's idea of what your normal weight should be.
What about the role of the thyroid in all of this? My mother used to have a weight problem, and she always blamed it on her thyroid.
Well, that's convenient. That is. Well, the thyroid is one of the hormonal factors that regulates metabolism, and certainly people who have too much thyroid are going to have it tuned up. And if you don't have enough thyroid, it's going to be tuned down. But most people have, you know, thyroid hormone within normal range. I wish it were as simple as one factor, but I don't think that it is.
We go now to Jane from Manhattan. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hi. I see powdered amino acids in a can. Are they effective, and why do people take them?
This is back to my health food store question.
The health food store, those wonderful cans that look like they're oil cans, and they're for bodybuilders, because the word is out on the street that bodybuilders need phenomenal amounts of protein. And these are usually whey protein, the protein from milk in powdered form, that give bodybuilders lots more protein. I think they're taking in far too much, and I worry about their long-term kidney function.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We have Carl now from Manhattan. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, you had brought up thyroid, and that's why I'm calling, because I have a sluggish thyroid, And you know, I'm not obese, but I'm about, I would say, about 15 pounds overweight. I'm 74. And I'm fairly active. I walk a lot. And I'm on the fourth floor of a walk-up, so, you know. And I do
great.
A certain amount of stretching and lifting light weights most mornings.
So you sound like you're in pretty good health. What's the problem? You're 15 pounds overweight?
Yeah, what's the problem?
Well, you're not 50 pounds overweight.
And also, I don't have much energy.
Ah.
How do you get up those stairs?
Well, actually, getting up is easier than going down because I have... I'm going to have my left knee replaced at some point. But you know, it's a combination of, you know, not feeling energetic. And, you know, I'd like to lose about 15 pounds.
Unfortunately, I don't know a better way than eating less and trying to introduce vegetables into your diet. But the, you know, and if you've got a sore knee, that's hard to do. I hope you get that fixed soon.
My guests are Marion Nestle of NYU and Rosalind Coleman of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We're talking about metabolism on today's Please Explain and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. The next caller is Donna from Point Pleasant, New Jersey. Hi, Donna. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay.
My question is this. Now, I'm an avid juicer. I juice almost every day, fresh carrot, spinach, apple, whatever I can find organic, lemon. I also eat ground flax seeds and shakes with organic fruits. My question is this. I'm very healthy. I have chronic insomnia, though, and I do take Ambien. I've tried everything. I'm very smart when it comes to, you know, reading about your brain and your metabolism and all that. But I still have not found, there's two questions actually. So do raw foods, digestive enzymes, when you ingest them that way by juicing, does that help your metabolism? And also, do you have any advice about sleeping? And please don't tell me to take melatonin. I've tried it. And I've tried meditation and sleep tapes and health sleep clinics and 9 doctors.
Rosalind?
Well, I don't have advice about insomnia. I think this is a terrible problem, but
it's unrelated to metabolism.
Well, it probably is related, but I'm not sure what to say about it. But as far as the enzymes that are present in raw foods, what happens is the processes of digestion inactivate those enzymes rather rapidly. And so those enzymes that are present are really proteins. They're made up of amino acids. And the acid contents of your stomach denatures or inactivates those enzymes. So once they get into the small intestine, they are treated exactly the same as if you had cooked them for an hour. So there's really no difference in my mind. I hope Marion's going to agree with
you.
She's been nodding her head.
I totally agree.
Thank you so much. But we'd like to believe that the raw vegetables. I love raw vegetables.
Well, they're delicious.
For years I was telling myself, well, this is because they're healthier for me.
Well, they may be because they certainly will have.
I always think I'm killing the vitamins when I cook
them.
Well,
some of the vitamins will be killed by cooking, but not all. But I like them. I love carrot juice. I think it's absolutely delicious. So I say keep drinking juices. It's a great way to get at least part of your vegetables.
Bob from New Jersey, how you're on the air?
Yeah, hi. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. It's a very mild case. It was caught early, and they put me on testosterone eliminating drugs, and starting about June. And since then, I didn't even gain weight, but my whole body changed. The stomach got bigger, and then now I'm starting to gain weight, and I'm kind of, I mean, I guess.
Then let me just generalize the question. Do testosterone and estrogen play a role in metabolism?
I'm sure they do. I mean, they would
have.
Because
we've been talking about
menopause. They would have to. Rosalind, help with this one, please.
Well, testosterone is clearly important for improving muscle mass. So that with a lack of testosterone,
there is, I think, a diminished ability to put on muscle mass. This is why all those Olympic athletes got into trouble by using something very similar to enhance their muscles. With estrogen, we've already talked now about the changes that occur with menopause. So clearly estrogen is having some sort of effect. But, you know, estrogen, the menopause is very obvious in women. And we see the effects right away. But there are probably hundreds of other changes that are occurring also in the kinds of and or amounts or relationships between the hormones that we have as maturing women, and just because
and men too,
right? And I was going to say in men, it's not so obvious.
Women tell me men never mature.
In men, it's not so obvious when that change occurs, but I think there's a progression as one ages, and unfortunately, you know, we have to accommodate ourselves to these changes.
Now, somebody else asked about the role of gut bacteria on metabolism. Do they play a part?
Interesting. Yes, this is something really new and very interesting. When scientists take animals and raise them without any germs in their guts at all, those animals are slim and have a very difficult time gaining weight, even on a kind of diet where normal rats and mice would become tremendously obese. These animals remain slim, and it's clear that the bacteria in our guts are helping us digest nutrients and utilize dietary nutrients in a better way. Now, this is not so good for us because
should we be eating yogurt?
Well, we already have bacteria that are helping us gain weight. There's no, if you see what I mean.
No, the question is, should we be taking antibiotics and kill all the bacteria in our guts? I think that would be a very bad idea.
That would be a bad idea.
But we have to be aware of it when we take antibiotics, because sometimes they do kill an illness, that we have to restore all of that bacteria to our guts.
But there are questions now as to whether people who are very fat have different kinds of bacteria, much more effective bacteria, perhaps, than people who are very slim.
We have to leave it there. We have to leave it with a little bit of mystery left because we've run out of time. Dr. Rosalind Coleman is a professor of nutrition and pediatrics at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Dr. Marion Nessel is the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU. Thank you both so much.
Pleasure.